Thank you. WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as U.S. cities deal with the reality or the prospect of federal police and assorted aggro boys rolling through their streets looking to detain anyone whose looks they don't like, and anti-fascist human beings showing up to say no to all of that, corporate media outlets like the New York Times have a corporate media quandary. How do you pretend you support free speech while satisfying your corporate overseers who don't? That's how you get to Times-style spluttering like that with regard to Portland. Quote, Democratic leaders in the city and state have pleaded with President Trump and the courts to trust law enforcement records, both local and federal, that describe the demonstrations as small and comparatively calm. But in the bifurcated media world of 2025, one side's comparative calm is the other's hellscape. Close quote. Well, one of these descriptions is true, and the other is fabricated, as Sharif Sarkar writes for Fair.org, but the New York Times finds its peace in telling readers that it's just, in their words, dueling versions of reality. So silly you, imagining that First Amendment-protected journalists would actually be about sorting out those versions. Trump and his enablers have a very unsecret plan to officially define anyone who opposes their agenda of white supremacy, imperialism, patriarchy, any dissenters as terrorists, as the enemy within. The question is no longer if that's happening, but just how we respond. And that response is enriched by an understanding of history. We are in a fight for our right to speak up, but it's not the first time. We'll learn from Chip Gibbons, Policy Director of Defending Rights and Dissent, about the old in the new counterterrorism project. Also on the show, the Department of Agriculture says they're defunding the annual survey on food security. That doesn't mean the predictable harms from the budget bills and other cuts won't happen. It just means that policymakers will have less reliable information to use to respond to them. We'll hear about that from Cara Brumfield, Vice President for Housing and Income Security at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. They think Antifa is an organization with a leader who has a girlfriend. They're so dumb. Threats from the Trump White House to, in Stephen Miller's words, identify, disrupt, eliminate, and destroy what they call a network of domestic terrorists might sound vague unto nonsensical for people who understand that Antifa means anti-fascist and think that being anti-fascist should not be controversial. But it is. And the weird vagueness of the descriptor, not so much a bug as a feature. When it comes to defending our baseline right to free expression and dissent, and that is where we're at, we need to know what we're fighting if we're going to fight it. And that means looking not just at the users, but at their tools. Chip Gibbons is Policy Director of Defending Rights and Dissent, where he edits the Gaza First Amendment Alert. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Imperial Bureau: The FBI, Political Surveillance, and the Rise of the U.S. National Security State. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chip Gibbons.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be on Counterspin. It's a vital news resource.
Well, thank you. And I want to start by saying I think of this as dipping a cup in the river of the conversation that we need to have. But in your recent piece for Dropsite News, you indicate that, yes, something new is happening in this government's crackdown on dissent to their authoritarianism, but it's not resting on air. What do we need to understand as some of the precedents, historical or legal political precedents, that the Trump administration is relying on in what feels like a wildly dystopian abuse of law? What steps got us here?
Yeah, so let's start with what Trump has done. Trump has issued an executive order decreeing Antifa to be a domestic terrorist organization. As you mentioned in your intro, Antifa is not an organization. It is an idea or ideology. It stands for anti-fascist. And there is no statutory domestic terrorism organization designation. Of course, Trump can call anything he wants, but it doesn't have the same effect as designating someone a foreign terrorist organization, which opens up a whole range of criminal penalties for providing material support or providing banking to them. He also issued a memo called National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, which is basically building on the Antifa executive order to lay out Trump's blueprint for crushing what he claims is an organized movement of left-wing political violence. And the way they talk about Antifa is a lot the way in which, you know, counter-subversive used to talk about the Communist Party. If there was a protest against police brutality in Milwaukee or an anti-war protest in Tampa. We are both part of the same sinister communist plot that was skeptically orchestrated and not, you know, at all organic, right? That was sort of the conspiratorial mindset. And that sort of mindset continues on with the non-existent Antifa replacing the phantom communist party. The thing about the memorandum that's really important to note is, for the most part, there are no new laws here. There are no new agencies. There are a couple of bureaucratic restructurings given Stephen Miller, a greater role in national security policy, which should horrify everyone. But for the most part, Trump is building off of previously existing frameworks, previously existing bureaucracies, and previously existing laws. And that we have to remember that decades of national security policy have gotten us to where we are. I've had a couple people say to me, wow, this is unprecedented, using the FBI to go after domestic political dissent. Oh, and yeah, I know. And this was a left-wing journalist, too. And it's like, no, it's not unprecedented. I mean, a lot of what he's doing is building on what the FBI has already been doing. Let me give you an example. In the executive order, he said Antifa is a militaristic anarchist enterprise. I think they meant militant, but they said militaristic anarchist enterprise. Well, the FBI has a type of investigation it carries out called an enterprise investigation. And of its enterprise investigations into domestic terrorism, it has a subcategory of investigation called domestic terrorism, terrorist enterprise investigation, anarchist extremist. Well, what's an anarchist extremist? It's somebody who's against capitalism or corporate globalization. Janine, the FBI has not updated their anarchist definition since the World Trade Organization protest. You can tell by that one. But then you look at what Trump does in the memo. He lists all of these ideologies. What's on there? Anti-capitalism, anti-Americanism, anti-Christianity, extremism on gender. I don't know what that means. So taking certain ideologies, very broad ones, whether it's opposition to corporate globalization, then saying these ideologies are the ones that are engaged in violence and we're going to prevent and disrupt the violence before it occurs. A number of astute people have pointed out that the memo, by using the phrase disruption, very clearly monitors the old Hoover description of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. And that's absolutely correct. But the FBI has repeatedly used that framing well after counterintelligence program was, you know, officially disbanded. Ashcroft and Mueller, after 9/11, talked about preventing and disrupting terrorism. In 2009, the FBI released their terrorism strategy. It was a disruption strategy. And since the war on terror, the FBI has adopted something called a preventative approach to terrorism. And they said, you know, we're no longer going to be a law enforcement agency that prosecutes people for terrorism after the fact. We're a national security agency. We use intelligence to prevent and disrupt terrorism. In order to achieve this transformation, they repeatedly lessened the rules on the FBI. So now the FBI can open a type of investigation called an assessment on someone who it has no evidence to believe threatens national security, which is a very broad term, but they don't even need evidence of that, or will violate a federal crime. So you have a model that says we're going to prevent terrorism before it happens. The FBI we're going to define terrorism by political ideology. And the threat today is anarchists, which are people who are anti-capitalist, anti-globes, anti-American, extremists on gender. What is the FBI agent reading these orders going to do? They're going to go out and look for everyone in their area of responsibility that they think has anti-capitalist, extremist on gender views. I have no idea, you know, how the FBI... And these are Joint Terrorism Task Force, too. These are the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. So a lot of them are staffed by local police operating as FBI terrorism officers under FBI guidelines. So now you have someone who's like the Boise police officer. He's been deputized by the FBI to run the terrorism task force. And now he's told he has to find all the terrorist in Boise who have extreme views on gender. You know, it's a nightmare situation.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like thought crime.
It is thought crime. Right. It is. It okay. is. So the logic of a lot of the preventative approach was this claim from groups like the Heritage Foundation and these right-wing congressional committees that political movements produce terrorism. So, of course, you had to preemptively surveil the political movement, even if you didn't have specific threats of crimes or people being agents of a foreign power or anything like that. Now, obviously, that was not applied equally. They want to go after particular left-wing movements they didn't like. And so when we talk about the preventative approach being adopted after 9/11 and the preventative approach being the driving force of Trump's national security presidential memo number 7, it's not just that it's written in such a way that it opens the door to political policing. That was the original intent. Right. And Ken Klippenstein, the independent reporter, has been monitoring which mainstream outlets are commenting and which ones aren't, and very few are. It's very much an under-the-radar story. Part of the reason was this memo came out, and then 3 hours later they indicted James Comey, so Comey was the story of the day. But also, they don't like to cover the FBI as a political police force. I mean, part of the reason why J. Edgar Hoover was so successful was he had the media behind him. And it's still the same way. When you see stories in the media about spying on protesters or left-wing groups, it's always like an isolated incident. Like, wow, can you believe this happened? And it's like, yes. Yes, I can believe this happened because I've read all of the other stories in your paper about this happening, which you somehow never connect the dots between and presented a coherent overall narrative.
Well, we're going to put a pin in it just for today. We've been speaking with Chip Gibbons from Defending Rights and Dissent. They're online at rightsanddissent.org. The piece we were talking about is on dropsitenews.com. Both of those sites, not for nothing, could use your support right now. Thank you, Chip Gibbons, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me back.
Everywhere there is government, there is dispute about how government should work. How do we leverage the power of the state to support the people? The only thing you can say about such arguments in advance is that wherever they land, they have to be grounded in information. We can disagree about outcomes or implications, but if we don't start from the same data, we're not actually in conversation. That's why our next guest has been raising the alarm bell on the Trump administration's gutting of the accuracy and availability of federal data and official statistics. Cara Brumfield is Vice President for House and Income Security at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She reported with Victoria Hunter Gibney on the diversion from mission of federal statistical agencies under Trump. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Cara Brumfield.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's one thing to say, for example, people need food support and we need to figure out how to address that. It's an entirely another thing to say, well, we don't know how many people need food support, so we'll just say whatever we want to say and other people can dispute it and it'll just count down to, I don't know, who shouts the loudest, you know, who has the wealthiest donors and the most media space. You know, in terms of policymaking, there's hardly a more keystone issue than data collection. But it's the sort of thing you don't notice its absence, right? So just starting where the piece that the center put out starts, one way you can eliminate that information gathering, that data collection, is just to stop funding it, right? And that's something that we're seeing today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're seeing cuts to all sorts of federal data collections that we use to make informed policy decisions. And one of the most recent, of course, being the defunding of our annual survey on food security, which is happening at the same time that we're seeing the largest ever cuts to food assistance through SNAP. So how will we be able to measure the impact of those cuts to SNAP, our country's extremely successful food support program? How will we measure the impact of these cuts on families who rely on those benefits to be able to put food on the table? We won't. We won't be able to do that without reliable access to accurate and unbiased federal data. In this case, through our survey questions on food security, which have just been cut. There are a variety of data collections that are being cut or that are facing proposed cuts. I'll talk a little bit about the 2030 census, the decennial.
Please.
The decennial sort of underpins all of our federal data collection because it's the only time that we attempt to collect information about every person living in the country. And so without fully funding the decennial census, we're putting the accuracy of that really important, fundamental, foundational, constitutionally mandated data collection at risk. And that has knock-on effects for all of the other federal surveys that we do. And it's not just funding, these funding cuts, which are deeply problematic for a lot of reasons, but it's also the politicization of the federal statistical system. In order for us to have a federal statistical system that works, that does what we need it to do, it has to be unbiased, it can't be politicized, and it has to be sufficiently funded. Because like you say, we need to be able to make decisions based in facts and not just based on who's the loudest voice in the room or who has the deepest pockets, right? So when it comes to funding, a lot of things happen. One, we lose staff capacity. We have brilliant minds in the federal statistical system who have been innovating on how to collect information in the best ways to serve all of the uses. And the Census Bureau, for example, is experiencing some brain drain. We're losing some of those folks from those positions because of this administration's actions. And further, if we want to keep up, improve, modernize, you know, meet the evolving needs of our nation, we have to invest in the research that's necessary to keep up. Now, changes like this mean that not only can we not modernize and improve on the way that our federal statistical system collects these data, but we're taking some huge steps backwards and losing some fundamental, really core information that we've relied on for decades in ways that are just completely unprecedented.
Please expand, you know, because I think to some people this sounds like a bland bureaucratic issue, and it's actually an issue with people at the sharp end. So when you talk about we're stopping to collect data, there are impacts of that, and I would ask you to talk a little more about that.
So, for example, if the Survey of Income and Program Participation, or the SIP as it's called, is cut, we'll lose really important information about families' experiences with benefits programs like Medicaid, SSI, WIC, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, SNAP, school breakfast, school lunch, just all kinds of programs that support the needs of families in this country. And we use that information to make decisions about how to change or improve the policies around these programs. And so if we want these programs to be effective in meeting people's needs and efficient in how they're run, we need to have high-quality, reliable, unbiased data on how they're working, what's not working, and what needs to change. It's cliche, but it's true that knowledge is power. In this case, it's very true because by taking control of our access to accurate, unbiased information, these kinds of changes are reducing our power to affect meaningful, positive change for families in this country through evidence-based policymaking. And what that means is it's reducing our ability to ensure that every family has the support they need to have food on the table, that they don't have to make decisions between buying diapers and paying the rent or buying medicine. This is very real for people, and it can feel disconnected when we're talking about data and surveys, and there are so many acronyms. But at the end of the day, this is information that we use to make good decisions that have huge impacts on a huge number of people's lives in this country, and can be the difference between having the support you need and facing real avoidable hardship.
Well, thank you for that. And I just want to ask a final question about media, because I often try to avoid saying things have been politicized, only because I understand how, for some people, political means partisan, and partisan means our guys versus them guys, and then everything gets lost in this understand of partisan grievances. So whatever is at hand, if Democrats want it, then I think I don't want it. And I blame media for a lot of that, for not disaggregating that kind of conversation and talking about what people need and the place of power. And I have just a lot of concerns about the way particular issues are presented to the public through the news media, which I know is where a lot of people are getting their understanding of what's going on. And so I just wonder if you have thoughts about how journalists could be helpful in terms of explaining what's at stake, explaining what's happening, and taking it outside of Democrat, Republican, and just making it about people.
Yeah, and I certainly agree. When it comes to facts, when it comes to understanding the reality of what's going on in our country, it really shouldn't matter which end of the political spectrum we fall on, because we should all share the value of wanting to make decisions that are based in evidence and based in reality.
Right.
But unfortunately, because information is so powerful, it gets manipulated for political gain. And I think the role of the media is just what you said, presenting information about what's going on, not because of which side of the aisle, so to speak, is raising the alarm, but because it's something that affects all of us. And it's something that is going to have repercussions that sort of reverberate for years to come. And I'll add that it's not just progressives who are worried about the federal statistical system.
Right.
Conservatives as well have spoken out and shared concerns about the reliability and the accuracy and our access to this really important information.
If we're going to have a conversation, we have to start from a basis of information. That shouldn't be, and I don't want to say, like, let's be bipartisan, because that language is very coded and weird to me now. But I really am just saying, for reporters, get the actual information, like start from the actual information bed. That shouldn't be too much to ask from journalists.
Yeah, I mean, journalists are just so important to our democracy, to the functioning of our democracy, because like you said, they're sort of the gatekeepers in some ways of information and how we understand what's going on in the world. And, you know, this is an issue of democracy. When you think about the decennial census, for example, it's congressionally mandated because it's used to determine apportionment and to draw districts, voting districts. And so what that means is that it's deeply tied to fairness in political representation and political power. So manipulating the decennial census for political gain is so deeply undemocratic. And we need to talk about it in those terms. So a fair and accurate census is key to making sure that everyone has that political power that they're entitled to. And at the same time, journalism has an important role to play in our democracy by making sure that people have access to the accurate factual information that they need to be able to exert their political power in ways that align with their own best interests.
Thank you so much, Kara Broomfield. We've been speaking with Kara Broomfield, Vice President for Housing and Income Security at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you so much, Kara, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. You can find more information on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Michael Cherry and Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as U.S. cities deal with the reality or the prospect of federal police and assorted aggro boys rolling through their streets looking to detain anyone whose looks they don't like, and anti-fascist human beings showing up to say no to all of that, corporate media outlets like the New York Times have a corporate media quandary. How do you pretend you support free speech while satisfying your corporate overseers who don't? That's how you get to Times-style spluttering like that with regard to Portland. Quote, Democratic leaders in the city and state have pleaded with President Trump and the courts to trust law enforcement records, both local and federal, that describe the demonstrations as small and comparatively calm. But in the bifurcated media world of 2025, one side's comparative calm is the other's hellscape, close quote. Well, one of these descriptions is true, and the other is fabricated, as Sharif Sarkar writes for fair.org, but the New York Times finds its peace in telling readers that it's just, in their words, dueling versions of reality. So silly you, imagining that First Amendment-protected journalists would actually be about sorting out those versions. Trump and his enablers have a very unsecret plan to officially define.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are renewing our call for the public's assistance.